This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's access media station, Plains FM, and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Welcome to Terra Nova Earth Talks. We speak with cutting-edge experts and wise elders from across the globe on the issues and action our Earth is calling for. Brought to you by the Terra Nova Foundation, driving environmental change through human connection and collective action.
Hello, kia ora. Today, to kick off the Terra Nova Earth Talks podcast, we are going to talk to the land beneath our feet. It's so important when talking about environments that we start with where we live and breathe, recognising the parts of the earth that talk to us most closely. We're here in the studios of the Plains FM radio station in Ototahi, Christchurch. It's the second biggest city in Aotearoa, New Zealand, and it's home to extraordinary wildlife and a range of ecosystems, including wetlands, lakes, estuaries, coastal forests, and marine sanctuaries. Central Ototahi is built upon a network of wetlands, waterways, and springs that were formed by the actions of the local river, the Waimakariri, and a network of underground aquifers. Ngāi Tuahiriri is the local hapū, that's the Māori tribe, that holds mana whenua. Mana whenua is the traditional rights and responsibilities over an area, and they have those over the city centre. Historically, the city has been an abundant area for food and flourishing wildlife. And today, the wetland city has just under 400,000 people and is growing fast. It is a hub for the region and a gateway to Antarctica. More and more people are moving to the city to benefit from the opportunities and the access to the wonderful outdoors. However, like most places in the world, the city's wildlife is at risk and the fragile ecosystems are increasingly threatened. We have seen earthquakes, floods, fires and droughts, pollution and urban expansion, among many other very dynamic changes. The land and the water underneath our feet here today is our life source, and there is much to be done to ensure we protect it and turn it around so that it thrives once again. So, that leads us to our guest for this podcast, a woman who's played crucial roles in the city, who leads a world-class philanthropic organisation, and who is a critical part to the recovery and restoration of the city's ecosystem. Today, it's a great pleasure to welcome Amy Carter, Chief Executive of the Christchurch Foundation. Amy, thank you for being here today to talk about our home, Ototahi Christchurch. Yeah.
Thanks very much for the opportunity, Rose, and tēnā koutou, everyone. Lovely to talk to you.
So, let's kick off. Ototahi Christchurch is a remarkable city, as we both know. And as I've mentioned, it's surrounded by wide ranges of ecosystems and wildlife. As a daughter to the city, you've grown up here. What are some of your childhood memories of the wildlife as you were growing up? Mm. Do you have any kind of visions of what it was like as a kid here?
Well, I had the fortune to grow up in a seaside suburb of Ototahi Christchurch called Tianopoto, which is Taylor's Mistake, which is infamous as a surf beach and a surf life saving club, but it also has incredible biodiversity. And my parents had a batch on the coastline at a place called Boulder Bay. So if you're walking out to Godley Head at the entrance to Littleton Harbour, there's a cluster of seaside batches that occasionally flood when the swell's big enough. And I had an idyllic time growing up there. In particular, over the summer, my father worked on the wharf at Littleton and was a mad multi-sporter. So he'd kayak or run to Littleton to go to work every day.
Wow.
And my mother and I would live at Boulder Bay with our dog, and the chickens would come too, and the banties would wander around Boulder Bay. We had a big veggie patch, and we would fish for and collect kai moana for our food, veggies out of the garden, and so that was a pretty idyllic childhood. And actually my godfather lived in Taylor's Mistake, and he'd run out with a loaf of bread, a bottle of milk and newspaper — I'm aging myself with a bottle of milk — in the morning to refresh supplies. So we had eggs, you know, had everything we needed. And it was an idyllic way to spend summer when I was little.
Yeah.
And then living in Sumner when we weren't holidaying around the corner, you know, childhood adventures on bikes all around the cliffy outcrops, in and out of the caves, hunting in the rock pools. You know, I couldn't be happier with how I grew up and the lifestyle we had.
So you grew up pretty connected then to the earth beneath your feet, but also the water.
Yeah.
And I know you're a great swimmer. We have a swimming background here. So quite connected, didn't think, you weren't conscious of the environment as a separate thing. Was it just part and parcel to you?
Yeah, water in particular, I couldn't function without it, and that runs in the whānau. So Dad was went to the World Surfing Champs. You know, we are — water lives and breathes us, and if I'm unhappy or really happy, you'll probably find me in the ocean. It's where I go to be calm and re-energise. Yeah,
amazing. Mm. So one of the things that I was keen to talk to you today about was the city has had a lot of changes. So since you've grown up, it's quite a lot different. Mm. And I grew up here too. And when I got into my 20s, I went over to Europe for 20 years. So I have had the contrast of growing up here and then coming back recently. So I've missed a bit. And I know that the city's gone through a huge amount of change, particularly when I was overseas. It's been, you know, when you look at the earthquake, which we have to mention because it was such a significant thing that happened in 2011. But we, as a city, we've been shaken up many, many times over the last 200 years.
Mm.
But none quite so devastating as the earthquake in 2011, where we had 185 people were killed and there was widespread damage. Since the earthquake, there's been over 1,500 buildings that have been demolished. You know, the core of the city was really almost flattened. So I'm keen to ask you about the changes from that beautiful, idyllic childhood to some of the things that have happened to the city and how the environment has changed over that time, or if it has changed.
I think it's also important to remember that we lost 11,000 homes as well, which is huge. A lot, you know, it's quite simple to say. And, you know, I'm nearly in my 50s. So, you know, time does pass us and things evolve. And I suppose what, you know, deaths and the losses aside, which were horrific and should not be forgotten, what the earthquake has done, and I think we're now at a point where we can have this conversation, it provided us with an opportunity to stop, think and reboot. And now, 11 years on, we're starting to see the benefits of that thinking and that stop, take a breath. How could we make things better? And if we're going to replace what was here, do we replace exactly, or do we actually stop and think, what does a modern city look like? What is it that the hopes and dreams are of our residents in terms of making this the most wonderful place to live, work and play? And you know, I genuinely think that we've come a long way on that journey, and we're starting to see the rewards of that thinking. And at the time, it was tough, you know. There was compulsory acquisition of land. People were overlaying a vision for the city that not everybody agreed with. And, you know, and it was different than what we're seeing in other cities around the world. It was low rise. It had wide boulevards with lots of connectivity to the Otakaro, the river that runs through our city, and our wetlands and those sorts of things, and a big push for a return to endemic. Now, to someone like me, that's super exciting. But for a lot of people, that was a lot of change.
Mm.
And change can scare people.
Mm.
So it has taken time to work through that journey.
I want to take you back, though, to the time after the earthquakes. You said that it took some time to see some of the changes. And I know from, you know, from some of the experiences I've had in different parts of the world that
There's often an expectation that if you have a disaster, that's everything comes right really quick. And people quite often say, oh, you know, why didn't they rebuild it, you know, with a perfect sustainability agenda? And why didn't it, you know, built so that it's it has all sorts of ecological value as part of the plan? Of course, the reality is that post a disaster, there's a lot of things going on. And so if you could just talk a little bit to that, the kind of the reality of the process as opposed to the aspirations that I know lots of people had, but maybe didn't happen in the way that they were hoping at the time.
I think especially it would be potentially a lot easier to do it if we weren't a democracy. In the countries where we've seen post-disaster recovery happen a lot more efficiently, when you look at their system, it's very autocratic. Mm. We're not that. You know, we're a democratic society, so any change has to be led by the community for the community, and politicians are a vehicle for that. They don't get to say what happens. Mm. So I think we need to understand that process and apply it here to New Zealand, where we are very we don't like hierarchy. We actually, you know, overtly revolt against it. You know,
it's too true.
You know. You meet the Prime Minister of New Zealand, you shake their hand and call them by their first name. That just doesn't happen in other parts of the world. Mm. And so I think that was always going to take time. And anyone that had any involvement in infrastructure would have told you it was going to take a longer time to get ready. Because effectively, because we're sitting on a giant wetland as an urban area, and if you talk to Māori that were here, and I remember talking to Sir Tipene O'Regan and a few others, and they're going, you know, well, we would have told the Europeans not to build the city there. That's a dumb place. It's a wetland. It's a marsh. It's going to sink.
Mm.
Well, when the earthquakes happened, literally the city sank. A term called liquefaction, which I didn't know until the earthquakes happened, and I now know how to spell it. It's not easy. So everything settled. The sand moved, the water came up, and that was why large areas of residential city and the CBD were lost. And some of that may be lost permanently. We can't build back there.
Yeah.
So it was, you know, we had to work through the process of working and holding hands with people around, well, where you've lived for your entire life, you can't go back there because it's not safe.
Yeah.
Now, to rush that would have been horrendous in terms of the flow-on impacts that it would have had.
Mm.
And some people would still say now that it was rushed. You know, there's people still hurting. And it's got to be acknowledged. And some people may never get over that trauma.
And
that's part of that process. And I think in particular it was hard here because we have been the land of milk and honey. You know, not much happens here at the bottom of the world. We're lovely and safe and idyllic childhoods and those sorts of things. So, you know, if you look at somewhere like Turkey, who recently has just had such a horrific run, but there seems to be trauma happens more frequently in some parts of the world than certainly has in little old Aotearoa. So it was more of a culture shock for us as well that would happen here.
Yeah.
So we weren't as prepared and didn't have the inbuilt resilience, dreadful word, probably overused word, at that point in time as a community. So I think we've got to remember that you always have to take people on the journey, and we have to ask people what they want in order for recovery to work.
Mm.
And the emergency phrase is the easy part in many ways. The hard part is the recovery, because it's a marathon, not a sprint. It's intergenerational. You know, they didn't rebuild London after World War II overnight. There's still pockets of that are still getting redeveloped. You know, that's just the reality. And actually, all cities, modern cities, are constantly evolving and changing who they are. That's what keeps them vibrant and exciting, and it's when they're not thinking like that and don't have a mindset like that is when they start to fail and you see them empty out.
Yeah.
So
I want to pick up on that, the bit about the city sinking, right? Because that's one of the things that with Terra Nova that we talk often about is the difference between controlling the environment and living with the environment. And I think sometimes as humans, we like to take control. We see an environment and go, we can do something here. But often it's at the detriment of the environment that it's on.
Mm.
Now, you can't turn back time and to the point, you know, why did we build on a wetland? Perhaps not the smartest thing to do. So where we're at. So there's got to be a reality check with that. But
being able to actually walk through that and say, how can we, as we go forward, learn to live with it and make change that embraces that? And I think some of the work that you've been doing with the Christchurch Foundation is about that, and that some of the actions we take are may not seem significant at the time, but are real catalysts to the engagement that people make with the environment, rather than just always, let's do what we want to do and then think of the environment afterwards. So I really invite you now to talk a little bit about the work that you've been doing with the Christchurch Foundation.
Yeah. So I think what having been here and present and having a role around community engagement post-quake, it was really clear to me that we needed to ask residents of Greater Ototahi what was important to them and then use that to inform our work, our philanthropic work. And also when we're talking about, so the Christchurch Foundation is an endowment-based organisation, but we also work with large corporates to deliver their corporate social responsibility in Greater Ototahi as well. So smart people wanting to philanthropically invest will ask the question, where are the needs and the opportunities and how do you know? So on that basis, you've got to ask the question, otherwise you're just guessing. And a lot of philanthropy that happens around the world now, with the best of intentions, is often made, decisions made in a room, usually with a lot of white old guys who are well-intentioned but miss the mark. Yeah. So the first thing we did when we looked to establish this thing was, well, what is it? What are the dreams and hopes and vision that we have as residents for Greater Christchurch, and what does that look like? So we asked that question, and then we aligned it to the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals because they are the global benchmark for what the future should be. And that helped us develop a framework to help guide and inform generosity when it's coming here to help make things better.
Yeah. And you definitely add that bit. I know you're saying you respond to people as they come in saying they want to do something good. You're there to help guide them on that process too.
Yeah, I often laugh a little bit and say we're a bit like Tinder, but which is a bit naughty, but it explains that we're sort of a matching service. So we act on behalf of the donor to inform them so that they're making smart, informed philanthropic decisions. And that, and we use the opportunity and the levers that the advantages that the not-for-profit sector have over business and government, as in we can go where they won't or can't go, that we can be agile and responsive, and that we have people at the heart of all of our decision maker, that we use data to inform our thinking, and that we're really focused on making a difference in the long term, not just an election cycle, and also that we track and report on impact, because you can do all the best well-meaning things in the world, but if it doesn't change anything, what's the point? So those are all really fundamental parts of the philosophy and our approach. And then, so when we asked residents what was important to them, there was a few things that came through really clearly. And to summarise them, people want to connect to each other more, they want to connect to the planet, and they want to connect to this place. Now, so if we apply all of our work that we're doing and weave through those fundamentals, surely we've got to have a long-term impact towards meeting community aspiration.
And I think fundamentally people, that's what's in their heart, right, is people want to do good. I haven't met anybody so far in this wonderful city that I've gone, I want to do bad. People want to do good. They often just don't know quite how to do it. And so one of the things that I often say is you look inward, look to who you are, to what are the land and waters under your feet? What is your connection with that? Do you have a connection with it? And often people will right from the outset say, I'd like to do more of that because I get so busy and work so hard and then I try and connect afterwards. And
yeah,
of course,
or I don't know how.
Or yes, totally.
Yeah.
What do I do? Do I plant a tree?
Yeah, where do I start? Yeah. And some people are just simply overwhelmed, like, everything's so bad, I don't know where to begin. And I think the message that we've got is everyone can take a baby step. And if we all take a baby step, then we all move forward so much more quickly. And that's sort of the philosophy we've taken. So we've put into place opportunities for people to give in a way that has meaning and impact, that enables people to feel like they're part of something, part of a movement. They can participate in what we're doing. So whether it's planting a tree or walking down City Mall to celebrate diversity in our community, opportunities for people to gather and have fun and celebrate our similarities and our differences and be happy about that. And also, I mean, empowering the community to act. Rather than saying this is how it's done or we know all the solutions, it's actually talking to people going, we think you probably could do with a bit of help. What does that look like?
Yeah.
And then using that philosophy to apply to all the various programs that we're doing. And the environment came through incredibly strongly when we asked residents what was important to them. 83% of residents of Greater Christchurch listed it as their top, one of their top three priorities, which is being a city that connects to nature, where you can be in nature while you, where you live, work and play, and where a modern, sustainable version, endemic version of a garden city, which has been our iconography from the past. And when we look at it, that originally came back from, I think we hosted some big event in the Botanic Gardens 100-odd years ago, and when someone at that point in time from England said, oh, this is a garden city just like back at the motherland, and that stayed with us. Now, I don't think us being a garden city is going to change. And if anything, we're going to get more like a garden city. It just might be the how the garden city is applied.
Maybe a different type
of garden. And, you know, it may not be all clipped boxes, hedges anymore, but there's nothing wrong with that, you know.
Yeah.
But and interesting, I had some friends down for a sale GP in the weekend from Auckland. They were just raving about the canopy. So green here, and there's trees, big established trees. And so I think it's not about ripping things out. It's about adding levels and depth to what is already here.
Totally. And I think one of the things that I've noticed with the work that you're doing is, one is you're giving an opportunity for people to give. And look, I need to be totally frank about this. In New Zealand, we're less than 3% of giving goes to the environment, you know, at a time that's so totally critical in you know, the world right now. We need resources to do the work that needs to be done. So that's a really important part of what you're doing. But I think the other thing that I've noticed that you've been doing, and often underplay, is the joined up picture that you provide for the environment. So lots of people talk about, oh, we're doing this development of a city over here, and then we're doing these nice parks over here, and we're doing some planting over here. Whereas you tend to talk about the city as the whole thing connected. I mentioned in a talk once about how Earth equals us. And we are Earth. So what's good for us is good for Earth. What's good for Earth is good for us. And having that real connected view as opposed to separating environment out from other issues.
Yeah, well, they're intertwined. I can't understand how you can talk about that if there's no us or there's no planet. And I think intuitively, Cantabrians, the wider Waitaha Canterbury, we get that because we produce food, you know. We feed 11 million people out of this region. There ain't 11 million people here. And if you talk to landowners, and yes, I'm talking farmers, the vast majority of them have the same aspiration as the rabid greenies, which is for healthier rivers that their children can swim in, for smarter ways to use productive land to feed the world. And they're on that journey. I've yet to meet a farmer that is not on that journey, and they don't get the credit for it. Often, which makes me upset because we like to pick on them a bit. But it is all interrelated.
Yeah, and just to explain, the rivers in this area, so growing up, the rivers, I swam in all of them. It was a joy. That was the thing that we did was, you know, in the weekend, go down to the river and swim. Not quite as possible now. We have our rivers are polluted, and they look still the same, but the ecosystems, both in the water and on the riverbanks, are not the same.
No.
Sorry, that's just to...
Context, yes.
Yeah, give a little bit of context there.
So I think, but our community is an ecosystem. You know, the water from here literally flows from glaciers and snow in the mountain, and it either goes above ground or below ground to come out past our city into the ocean. Okay, that's reality. Now, the rivers are a lot shorter time frame than the going through the aquifers, which are hundreds, maybe thousands of years. We're still working that out. But the reality, we are part of that ecosystem, so you can't talk about it in isolation. And we know from simple best practice, you can plant a tree, but that's great. But if you don't weed it and you don't manage the pests around it, it won't thrive. So you can't talk about it in isolation. It has to be a holistic approach. And if we plant that tree, it's great that we've planted a tree, but does it support the native fauna that needs to go with it? Like, bugs are just as important to the ecosystem as the tree is. So how can you not look at things holistically?
Yeah, and actually some of the indicators that worldwide that people use to show where we're at is with insects, right? And that's where the concern is greatest, because our insects are disappearing. And in this country, our native invertebrates are really at risk and threatened. Most of them now are in that category. So we really need to do a lot better on encouraging an ecosystem where they can thrive. And all the things we can't see under the soil, or the bacteria, the fungi, and all of the ecosystem that sits underneath. We tend to think of a tree just as a tree, but of course trees are actually very active under the soil and above the soil. It's a magic that happens.
Yeah, and so I think it's interesting, because I've learned more about soil and what's in it and under it from farmers than I have from anyone, because they're on that journey too, and they're beginning to realise. And I think, you know, the pollution that we're seeing now in our rivers was from 30, 40 years ago, where we didn't understand this stuff, you know. So I think what we need to do is work collectively as a community, and that means all facets of our community, towards what we all share as a common goal, because we know that from the data. 83% of us, including the rural hinterland, all want to be in touch with our environment and to make it healthier.
Absolutely. And we're all part of it. So in this city, we also have to be mindful of our wastewater, because there are rivers flowing through the city. So most of our homes are connected to the water, whether we are aware of it or not, and our wastewater in particular has a big effect. So there's every one of us has an impact on the environment that's around us. So
totally. And just wee things, looking at the leafy suburbs and talking to some of my friends that are building new homes, and they're putting in copper spouting, and I'm like, the reality is the two most polluted rivers in our region are the Avon and the Heathcote that run through the city, and their springs are just beyond our city limits. That's not impacted by the rural hinterland. That's pollution coming from our city. And a lot of that will be runoff from roads. It'll be people putting up copper spouting unintentionally, wearing that copper kills more marine aquatic plants and fish than anything. So, you know, like, there's all these sort of simple decisions that we can be making. But I think the biggest issue is that up until now, the voices for nature have been scientists, who we undoubtedly need, but they're not very good as communicators as a rule. Okay? So we've got to be able to bring the two together, which is talk in a way to communities to empower them to act without making it doom and gloom, and also providing easy things to engage with and using language that they can understand.
And I think some of the time people call for more and more science, but I think most people on the ground know that we're a bit in trouble. Just a little bit. So I don't think the awareness is not there. It's that next step.
Correct.
Can you talk to some of the types of initiatives that you've got involved in? Because I think it's sometimes really helpful for people to know what can be done and what's out there, and some of how you've translated some of the thinking you've just been talking about into the action that you're supporting on the ground.
So one of the first projects we did in the environmental space, which we thought could have impact. So everything we do, if a donor comes to us and they've got a big enough checkbook, being very frank, we can look at scale. And how can we do something of scale that inspires people to act, grows awareness, and makes an environmental impact? So one of the first things we developed was a collaboration with our partner Meridian, who came to us, and we signed a partnership that we wanted to make Greater Ōtautahi greener, more environmental sustainable. And one of the other things we've talked about is smarter use of clean energy. So,
Meridian is a large energy company in New Zealand. Yep.
And they are 100% sustainable, which is great. So wind and water power, so great alignment for us.
Mm.
So the first thing we did is when we looked at the research from residents about what was important, and there was a really strong movement to increase the bird life in our central city.
Yeah.
So we just sat down and said, well, how could we do that? And luckily I'd been involved with a really cool organisation on Banks Peninsula, which is the peninsula that is part of our city, a volcano that's no longer alive, which was completely bush-clad, has been deforested, but there's been huge efforts to bring some of that endemic
back. Extraordinary area, actually. If you're ever in Christchurch, go onto Banks Peninsula. It's an incredible place to visit. And Amy was a key part of the Banks Peninsula Conservation Trust that have really activated that area from an environmental point of view as well.
Yeah, and that was landowner-driven. So farmers who own land there realised that some of the areas that had been deforested for growing sheep or cows actually weren't smart to have done it in those areas, and they were looking at ways to improve the health of their farm and the outputs of their farm, and had come to the conclusion that putting parts of it back into bush was a smart thing to do. So they've led that initiative. So Banks Peninsula had dropped to something like 3% forest covered, bush clad. And in the last 25 to 30 years, we've got it back to 15%. And that's been driven by the people that own the land, replanting the valleys and steep areas where you can't have stock, protecting their waterways. And we're seeing huge environmental outcomes of that. You know, we've got species starting to increase in numbers rather than decrease in numbers, and that's things like penguins, some of the sub-Antarctic birds that, mutton birds, I can't remember, titi. These are big birds that burrow. And we're starting to see invertebrates and things come back too because of these initiatives. So there's a wonderful project called Hinawai, which you should Google and look at, which was world-leading in the approach that they took to reforest this part of the peninsula, that now has over 1,000 hectares of endemic bush, either regenerating, including established canopy that had pockets that was there. And we've done some species reintroduction into there of some iconic, very noisy, somewhat stroppy birds called tui. And they're starting to slowly grow in numbers. But to encourage those nectar-feeding birds into the city, which was something, we're the only part of New Zealand that doesn't have tui anymore, so it was something to grab hold of for people to get excited about. So we've pitched to Meridian, why don't we build a corridor of endemic planting to attach, to connect Hinawai to the central city.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the work's already been done by the major landowners in the peninsula, but once we get off Lyttelton Harbour, Whakarapo, and into the CBD, it becomes very residential, a lot of parks and those sorts of things, and that hadn't been happened.
And I'll just add, I know 15% still doesn't sound a lot when you're getting in numbers, but there's a waiting list for people to plant and get covenanted, which means parts of their land and kept with native
protected for perpetuity.
For perpetuity, forever, which is amazing. Mm. So that number's just going to keep skyrocketing. But yes, come back to
So we said to Meridian, well, how about we create a corridor to encourage the bird life that's starting to re-establish on the peninsula into the central city? Because the central city planting plan has been largely endemic post-quakes, and we're definitely seeing a whole lot more of the right, what we call tuitaka, so the right endemic species that they feed, that nectar feeders feed off in the central city. So we just need to connect the two. And how do we, let's do a community project that raises awareness, plants more critical mass, and it gets people excited about it. And the Tui Corridor has been a huge success. We couldn't have been happier. We've planted over 45,000, I've lost track, trees in the last few years, or stems, into that area. All of our planting has been informed by the Tui expert in New Zealand, which is a scientist, Laura Moles, based out at Lincoln University. We're working with technical experts the whole way. And I think that's really important to understand that you ask advice and use the advice of the experts. And we've been working with landowners, large and small, to infill, raising awareness through Meridian's network, and they're happy to throw money at promoting that, which helps us spread the story, which is excellent. And we're pretty excited about that. And we've just...
And it's gone beyond Meridian, right?
Yeah.
Quite a lot of businesses. I was at one of your plantings at ARA, which is just behind us here in the studio, getting people engaged, students, lecturers and so forth out there, planting up their areas. Mm. So it's really, there's been a real... again, there's this wonderful magic when you get everybody kind of connected.
Yeah, it feels like a movement now.
Yeah.
And we certainly hear that. You know, I was in an event last night with a large engineering company, and they're going, how do we get involved in this? So people are literally queuing up, whether you're a homeowner or a major corporate, going, we want to be part of this. And we've then, now we're sort of 3 years in, we can't keep up with demand with people wanting trees of us. actually sourcing the trees is becoming an issue for us, because making sure that they're endemic and eco-sourced is really important to ensure the integrity of what we are planting.
And also, to the point we made earlier, that it's not just trees, right? You're planting, we say trees, but we're...
plants.
It's plants, it's flora, all range of endemic species. And in New Zealand, half of our flora are at risk or threatened of extinction. So we need that as well, just from a pure biodiversity point of view. So.
Yeah. So, and then now it's about understanding the impact of that and rebooting and thinking what next. So we've just partnered with the University of Canterbury and their geography department, and we've actually virtually mapped everywhere we've planted. We've overlaid that with established bush and major plantings that from various landowners, and then said, well, where do we need to infill? We then got the technical experts, the ecologists and things on board, and peer-reviewed that, and so that's now given us a plan for going forward. So we probably won't start any new locations for Tui Corridor plantings. What we're going to do is grow the critical mass in the ones where we can.
Yeah, right.
Pest that's management.
And now show the follow through.
Yeah. So that, you know, then that's the case study around, if we really want to make a difference, you've got to continuously evaluate, are we moving forward? What is next? How do we need to change to get better?
Which I think is one of the most important parts of anything, any work that's done environmentally or sustainability or climate action, whatever you're talking about. It's not easy to make an initial impact, but it's easier than the follow through. The follow through is the hard bit, when the kind of the gloss from the launch event goes, and you've now got plants that need to be nurtured and looked after over time. That's when the true champions, they keep with it and they keep supporting it and making sure that it flourishes. And so lots of things I've seen all over the world, actually, where trees or plants have been planted and then just left.
Yeah, weeding's so important. So if anyone wants to volunteer, you can through our website. We've got to run a few weeding programs. But I think that's an important part of too. So I suppose what that allowed people to do was a homeowner... We've, you know, taken the great work that the Banks Peninsula Conservation Trust and did in collaboration with DOC and other parties to bring the Tui back. We now actively promote and share the trees and other plants that you should be planting in your backyard to help with growing that critical mass. So it's about making it easier for people to engage with, giving it profile, shining a light on it. And then we do have planting days, weeding days, those sorts of things that we run, and that enables people to meet other people, to get outdoors and enjoy our flora and fauna, and feel like they're part of making a difference.
Yeah.
And that's good for your soul. It's good for your mental health. It ticks all those other boxes as well.
Every person that switches one of their plants, you know, if something's in your garden and it's no good anymore and you've got to pull it out for whatever reason, put in a native and, you know, get in contact to find out what kind of native with Terra Nova or with Christchurch Foundation. We're happy to help you to actually work out how you can start to really embrace the flora and fauna that is native to our area and is going to be good for the wetland that we sit on, right? That's the other thing.
And messy gardens are good. So you can have formal parts of your garden, but have an area that is a bit chaotic and messy that birds can fossick through and insects can live in, because that's really important. Yeah.
Now, I'm going to wrap up with you now. We could speak about this for a very long time, but we don't have huge amounts of time. So I'm going to wrap up with you. One of the things that people say to me at Terra Nova all the time, it's quite doom and gloom. How do you have hope when some of the statistics and a lot of the talk around environment and climate and sustainability are fairly overwhelming? And I certainly talk to the idea that we can do change that devastates an area very quickly, but we can also do change that restores and rejuvenates an area very quickly too. So for those people out there who thinking, what's the point? Is it really going to work? Are we really going to make a difference? Is there really hope in this? Or should we be better out the back building our bunker and, hunkering down for the days to come? What would you say?
There's always light from dark. Look, I'm an internal optimist, but I also believe, and the science is telling us very clearly that we still have time to do this, but we've just got to not muck around. Mm. So now is the time to act, and that every act that you take will contribute to a better world. And whether that's large or small, one of my bad habits, disposable coffee cups, just change, That's something that I'm trying to work on at the moment. It doesn't have to be huge, but a baby step will make a difference if we're all doing it. And I think the challenge is to all of us that are running programs around the space to better is get better at telling our stories and showing the success, because at the moment the breakthrough, the news cycle is nearly impossible. So we've all got to get better at sharing our stories using our own platforms and encouraging people to share so that we actually can see that things are changing.
Yeah. Wonderful. So I want to say a big thank you today, Amy, for coming into the studio, and really appreciated your take and to give a feel and flavour of Ōtautahi Christchurch. It's an extraordinary city. If you're listening and not been here before, then do come. Come with a sustainable form of transport, we would like.
Or we can offset your carbon travel.
Do venture in. If you live in the city and you're listening, engage. There's so much going on. Do get in contact with us get with it. This is an exciting time. For me, it's not a downtime. Actually, it's an exciting time. And the more that we do to help our ecosystems thrive, the better we're going to be for extreme events coming, which we know are going to come. But the more that our biodiversity flourishes, the more that we support things, the better we are and the more thoughtful we will be for when we're deciding what to do next.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Terra Nova Earth Talks. For more information on the content and links from this podcast, go to the Terra Nova website. That's terranova.foundation. To listen to other interviews in this series, go to the Plains FM website. That's plainsfm.org.nz. Search for Terra Nova Earth Talks. Also on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Bye for now.